Hello, this is Curtis Edwards, Vice President of Investor Relations at Hudson Investing. Are you ready to start building your multifamily portfolio? Kent and I are excited to announce our newest deal in Spartanburg, South Carolina. This 157-unit property offers a unique chance to acquire a B-class value-add property for just $120,000 per door. This is well below replacement costs. De-risking the deal even further is a favorable loan assumption with over 6 years remaining at 3.73% fixed. With 50 economic development projects underway and 70,000 jobs within a 20-minute drive, the South Carolina Upstate region is primed for above-average job, population, and rent growth. Don't miss out on this exclusive deal. Find the link in the description notes to learn how you can invest.
Especially as my career started taking off and I got busier with my CFO role, I realized that passive investing for me was really the right answer. And it really is the right answer for a lot of professionals because as you get busier in syndications, you know, you're really taking on your own job. And so that's how I came around to starting Sierra Capital Group.
Welcome to Right Around Real Estate, the show about how to passively invest like a pro. On each episode, I interview real estate experts who give their top investing advice, strategies, and tools, and I break down their insights into practical steps to avoid the pitfalls and make better investments. I want to help you passively invest like a pro. This is Ritter on Real Estate, and I'm your host, Kent Ritter. Hello, fellow investors. Welcome to another episode of Ritter on Real Estate, where we teach you how to passively invest like a pro. Today, my guest is Mark Sierra, and Mark is the co-founder of Sierra Capital Group, a firm focused on curating diverse private real estate investments. And Mark, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks a lot, Kent. Really happy to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to getting your perspective. You got a pretty unique background. We've got some similarities in our background, so I think that'll be fun to talk about. So let's start there. Before we dig into it, you know, tell people a little bit more about who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Well, I'll kind of go all the way back to, the beginning. I graduated from Iowa State University with an accounting degree, studied some engineering in there, but ultimately went to get my CPA and did some management consulting right out of the gate, right out of college. Worked for like Navigant Consulting and Ernst & Young, a couple of places like that, but ultimately went on my own around 2010. And started working for one of my clients actually along the way. And as that company began to grow, the founder brought me on eventually as their CFO. And so today I'm the CFO of that, what was once a client, but is now, you know, part of my portfolio. I'm an owner in the company and, do the day-to-day type CFO stuff. So, you know, became a busy professional that way. And along the way, I discovered real estate as well through my wife, actually, here in Chicago. Around the same time that I went out on my own as a consultant, I met my wife, who is a general contractor here in Chicago, and she introduced me to real estate as an option for investing. We were going to build our own house, and we bought some land. We eventually ended up turning that land into an investment properties and selling them instead of building our own house. Long story there, but it turned out to be kind of a light bulb moment for me because I really thought before that real estate was just for rich people and it really wasn't an investment that somebody like myself could get involved in. So when that happened, I really started to dig into what the options were. And we spent a lot of time doing, you know, development. We still do some of that here in Chicago. With her family business. But we also got into mobile home parks. We got into syndications, passive investing. And what I realized through that from around 2016 on, especially as my career started taking off and I got busier with my CFO role, I realized that passive investing for me was really the right answer. And it really is the right answer for a lot of professionals because as you get busier in syndications, you know, you're really taking on your own job. And so that's how I came around to starting Sierra Capital Group. in order to provide a way to passively invest in operators that have been around for a long time, providing a foundational investment for busy professionals like myself. So that's how we came around. And that's what we're doing today.
Gotcha. I gotcha. So you're still full time. You're working as your CFO, and you've identified a way to essentially act as a fund of funds and kind of pool investment money together. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. We've developed a lot of relationships over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years in passive investments. We've watched a lot of track records of investors, and we think that we've identified a number that, you know, we think have very long-term staying power, that are, you know, have deep connections and roots in their markets. You know, many of them have been around for 20, 30 years. And those are the types of investments I think are great for busy professionals that are looking for some exposure to private equity, especially real estate like this, and diversifying from their 401ks or their traditional investments into something that's more like what the institutions do. So allocating a little bit of their income or a little bit of their you know, nest egg from the traditional investments over to some private equity.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great. I mean, I think the more people that you can get investing in real estate in a safe way is going to benefit them and going to benefit everyone. I'm a huge proponent of diversifying into real estate, at least having a portion of your portfolio allocated. Like you said, you mentioned the institutions a couple of times. I mean, you know, if you look at the biggest endowments or the richest people in the world, they all have an allocation into real estate, right? And
that's right.
And we often wonder why as individuals, it's not so common. And I think exactly. A lot of that is access. It's just access. Access has become a lot better in the past, I don't know, five, six years. I mean, when I first started, there wasn't much. It's expanded much more. I think it's much more commonplace, but still it's difficult to find really solid operators, right? There's a lot of people out there raising money with varying levels of experience. It sounds like you guys have kind of gone to the extreme, finding 20, 30 year veterans. And what type of asset classes are you investing in?
So multifamily, of course, you know, that's a very foundational asset for, you know, almost everybody in real estate is multifamily. Self-storage is another, and mobile home parks or manufactured housing is another that, you know, it's been hot over the last couple of years, but it does have very attractive returns still, as well as a market that, you know, is kind of protected. It's not going away. There's a lot of demand for it. And so it does have some aspects of a very good long-term investment. And there's ways that improving those properties, you know, many of them been owned by mom and pops for a long time, small and consolidating power portfolios does have benefits for both residents today as well as investors. So I think there's a kind of a win-win there. And it's been a neglected area for, you know, at least the last 20, 30 years, I think. And some of this investment is really helping that area. So those are the three prime areas. We are looking today at trying to get into some more industrial, because that is an area that I see continuing to be, you know, expanding and attractive as we move more towards, you know, the Amazons and all of the deliveries, much more of that last mile and the infrastructure around warehousing is going to be important. And I believe that's going to continue as we see more moving towards, you know, e-shopping, you know, on the internet and that sort of thing, deliveries. So That's a very small part of the logistic network right now, but I believe that's going to be continuing to increase. So we're looking at industrial as well.
Sure.
Office space, you know, that's a question mark these days. Not really sure which way that's going to go at this point, but it could be one of those things that now's a great time to invest in office space. If you go to the right markets where maybe there's some depressed, you know, cap rates, or not depressed cap rates, depressed valuations, you know, higher cap rates due to, you know, uncertainty around that market or whatever. But, you know, we're not actively seeking office unless there's a great opportunity that's just screaming at us.
Sure. Yeah. No, a lot of risks there still, a lot of uncertainty. So just getting back to thinking about real estate, you know, you got involved and you're obviously a large proponent of it now. You've created this fund. But what is it that, I mean, beyond the diversification, I guess, which we understand. We understand the need to diversify and not have all our eggs in one basket. What else is it about real estate that has made you such a big proponent?
Well, I think it's kind of a natural bridge between, you know, your traditional bond investing, which is paying zero right now, and equities, right? It has a component of both because you have sort of an equity appreciation aspect to real estate as the asset, you know, grows in value over time while you hold it, but it also produces dividend-like returns through, you know, the rental income and distributions that the real estate delivers. So you've kind of got this like mixed investment that's doing a little bit of both of those things. So it's kind of a natural bridge in a portfolio. And that's one of the reasons I really like real estate. You know, besides the fact that so many people own it, it's a foundational kind of investment. You know, and they're not making more land and they're not, you know, you can build new things on the land, but, you know, it's sort of always going to be there, right?
Yeah. There's definitely limited supply. Right. And right. I think that varies, you know, kind of where you are, but overall, yeah, there's, we're not making any more of it. I think that's a good point. And I think that, yeah, from a return standpoint, you know, I think it can, you know, I think it is a good bridge. I think that goes back to diversification. I think oftentimes though, the returns can even be better than what you're seeing in either of those other asset classes.
So oh, absolutely.
On the return upside, it's also can have a lot of qualities. I think when we look at things on a risk-adjusted return standpoint, right? There's real estate has historically stood out because of the limited downside risk, depending on the type of investment you're making. You know, not all investments are the same. But the ability for appreciation that can typically outpace, you know, what you've seen in on the equity markets.
Absolutely, yeah, and there are comparisons out there. You can do Google searches and, you know, find all kinds of reports of, you know, comparing real estate or private equity to mm-hmm. the stock market, and it typically has better returns with less volatility, less risk, right? So that's another reason why it fits so well with a portfolio, I believe. You've got a risky end of maybe, you know, stocks, and you've got a very, very safe end of bonds, and somewhere in there is real estate.
Yeah, gotcha. So what is it? We talked a little bit about how real estate investing has become so much more the norm, right? We're seeing a ton of people get into real estate investing. What do you think is driving all this interest within real estate?
Well, I think a number of things. First, obviously the returns and people see that and they're interested in it, especially as the lower end, you know, of their portfolio, the bonds and the safe part of it is not paying anything. So you've got to go up the risk spectrum, right, to find yield and return. So much more people are seeking exposure to those assets that are producing cash flow or returns, and real estate is one of those. So that's a big thing. Access to capital. You know, we've seen a flood of spending and borrowing from the federal government that's out there. People have a lot more cash in their pockets these days to invest. So I think that is driving a lot of interest in, hey, what else is out there? Their feeling of, you know, maybe the stock market's overvalued. So what else can we go look at, and how can we find safety in our investments, and where can we put it that's not in the bank account or under the mattress, you know, earning zero or negative at this point with inflation being high at this point. So I think those there's a number of things driving the interest, and those are sort of the big key factors.
Yeah, and I think those all make total sense. I think those are being, we're seeing that in kind of a little bit of a microcosm over the past just a few months, right? As you see, mm-hmm. we see inflation, we see all kind of economic uncertainty, we see interest rates starting to move because of all that. How do you see all these new factors playing into you know, what, I guess what's happening now, and then what are you projecting over the next, you know, however far your crystal ball goes out?
Yeah, it doesn't go out very far these days with, you know, conflict in Europe and, you know, uncertainty about inflation and how long it's going to last, whether it, you know, the word transitory was sort of the word of 2021, but we're seeing whether that's actually the case and that it's being tested with, you know, a lot of this uncertainty coming out of the politics and the war. So I think we're back to an area of extreme uncertainty, which drives me back towards diversification is very important when you have very little, you know, crystal ball, as you said, that doesn't go out very far. So my prediction, I think we're going to see quite a bit of interest rate hikes over, you know, the first part of this year. I think they're going to aggressively attack inflation with interest rate hikes, but that will probably slow down quickly. I think there is an element of transitory inflation from last year, just a lot of bottlenecks and in the supply chain driving, you know, increased prices that have flowed through. Same thing with energy, but whether that becomes sustained and part of the mentality, and you know, whether producers are maintaining high prices and whether, you know, wage earners demand higher wages and all of that continues to perpetuate inflation is the question, whether it kind of gets ingrained in the psyche or not. And the uncertainty around the war, who knows what, you know, could create a downdraft, right? And stop all of this. You know, if they get too aggressive on inflation rates, or interest rates, I'm sorry. You know, we could see things quickly turn around in the other direction, especially with as much debt overhang as the country has at this point. A lot there on my crystal ball, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are all good points. I think that, you know, I share a similar point of view on interest rates. I think that, you know, if you look at the curves, the rate curves, you know, things are definitely going up and we're expecting to go up. We're starting to see hikes. We've heard the Fed say they may hike as many as 6 times over the next year and a half. They may hike at, you know, 50 basis point intervals versus 25. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it is relatively short term. I think the first lever they pull as the economy starts to slow down is the pullback on interest rates.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, over the next couple of years, we will see those rates go up. And I think it's important when you think about it from a debt perspective, what kind of debt are you using? Right. Because I mean, that's the number one thing that's going to be affected by your interest rate. You know, how long are you fixing it in? Are you fixing it in? Are you floating? Are you buying a cap? And kind of these different instruments. I mean, all these different debt instruments, I think they're just different tools. And you got to use the right tool for the right project. And I guess at the right time. And so right. I think that's where you reduce a lot of your risk in these investments is in the type of debt that you're choosing. In the timeframes that you're choosing, and if you're fixing or floating, and how you're protecting yourself with caps and other things. And so I think that's something to really focus in on in investments.
In your underwriting as well.
Folks are making. Yeah. I think in the underwriting also, as you're evaluating other deals, you know, what, just asking those questions around debt, I think are going to be one of the most important things over the next couple of years.
Absolutely. And they always should be, right? You always want to know what their debt strategy is, whether, you know, some firms have a, you know, a floating rate policy. They like the floating rate loans. Some people like fixed rate loans. And, you know, you want to understand at least the sponsor's strategy around that and how they employ it and protect against the downside of each of those strategies.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, you know, there's made a comment here around, new investors and operators in the market and maybe some big mistakes that you're seeing. Perhaps it's as you're evaluating your own deals or from other points of contacts, but maybe share some of that. You know, why do you think that's happening? What are some of the things where you see people going wrong?
Sure.
And so folks can maybe have the same perspective or avoid some of these things.
Yeah, where I see the biggest mistakes these days over the last 3 to 4 years as competition has increased. So we talked about this earlier. There's a lot of people getting into real estate, a lot of new investors, a lot of new sponsors. So there's a lot of capital. There's a lot of people chasing deals. We've seen cap rates go down and down and down, right? I don't know if they can get any lower at this point, especially with interest rates going up. And so what happens when you're a new investor or a new sponsor and you want to buy a property? You got to outbid everybody else that's trying to buy that property, right? Especially people who have been in the business for 20 or 30 years and have closing power. You know, they've got broker relationships. When they approach a seller, the seller knows that they're going to close, right? They know they have the money. They know they have the track record. So a new investor is going to have to pay more, most likely, in order to win that deal. And so what I see happening is new investor underwrites a property more aggressively than an experienced sponsor. And they're willing to pay more because they have underwriting that says, you know, rents are going to go up 10% for 5 years or whatever. And that may be realistic for this year, which is an anomaly, but that's probably not going to work for 5 years, right? So, and that's an extreme example. I don't see that very often, but that's the point I'm trying to make, is that usually it's driven by unrealistic underwriting expectations, and that they can either increase rents faster than anyone else or decrease expenses to an unreasonable level that's maybe not achievable, or they're not investing enough in the units, upfront to increase the rents. Maybe they underestimate taxes, you know, because when you buy a property for more than the last guy, those taxes are going to go up and quite a bit. And we're also seeing just tax rates go up on properties. So oftentimes the tax implication of a purchase are underestimated. So those are some of the examples that I see young sponsors making. And I think that's exacerbated today, especially with, you know, the low rates, being able to put even more debt on. You know, there's competition from the debt side as well, right? So you may get more leverage than you really should have on a property. And that's where you start to get into risky situations. When you've underwritten a property aggressively, you've over-leveraged it a little bit. And what happens when the market changes, or maybe you've got short-term financing that you need to refinance in 2 years, bridge loan or something. Those things I'm seeing much more often these days. Lots of bridge loans that need to be refinanced in 2-3 years. And who knows what's going to happen at that time. So All of those things are mistakes that I see made by new sponsors. And it's, you know, it's not a mistake if it works, but it's a potential, you know, red flag there.
Sure. So it sounds like in general, just overestimating on your underwriting, maybe taking on too much leverage. How much leverage do you see folks typically in the deals you're looking at? How much leverage do you see folks taking on? Because I mean, there's still that debt service coverage component that's going to limit the amount of leverage you're allowed to take. So where are you seeing that fall in now? Because most deals I see, really it hits debt service coverage before it actually hits any leverage thresholds. That's really what's been limiting the amount of debt you can put on deals.
Yeah. So what I've been seeing a lot lately, are you asking what is the debt service percentage that I've seen on properties? Because it varies by, you know, type of asset and that sort of thing, and sponsor. Some sponsors.
I'm asking more what type of, you just mentioned that one of the risks is being over leveraged. So I guess I'm asking kind of what is your definition of over leveraged? And
gotcha. You
know, what do folks look out for?
I think when you're getting above like 75, 80% is pretty leveraged on a property, right? You don't see that very often, but 70 to 75 is pretty typical. I see the more experienced operators more, especially in mobile home parks and self-storage, down around like 60 to 70. And a lot of these experienced operators will cap their leverage at 65 or 75%, no more than that. So somewhere in that like 60 to 70 seems to be the more experienced level, where they're taking a little bit more equity, putting a little bit more of that at risk, as opposed to more debt and leverage. The other area that I see a lot these days is this multi-tiered equity structure that is debt plus almost like a mezzanine debt kind of equity. That's like this 10%, you know, low participation in the upside. but it's almost like mezzanine debt that's unsecured, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got 75% leverage and you've got 10% mezzanine kind of debt at paying 10%. And then you've got this equity stack above that. It's like, that is a bit over leveraged in my opinion. So it's not exactly debt. It's not leverage, right? But it's sort of this hybrid. And then of course you have bridge loans. Well, preferred equity has different, you know, you can do different things. So you can have a pref with a higher split with the sponsors and investors. And what I was talking about is a pref that's a higher preferred return, but a lower split.
Gotcha.
Okay. Which is almost like a note, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we're definitely seeing kind of some interesting models out there. And I agree. I think leverage is something to look out for. I guess as folks move to more bridge loans and are able to get higher leverage, the thing to look out for is, you know, what's the time frame? What's their exit plan? How does the time frame, how does the term of the loan align with their exit plan? Right. I think one thing that we try to do in our deals is look for, you know, at least a cushion of a year from our exit plan. We want to have an additional amount of time beyond what we think it's going to take in case it, things just don't work out for whatever reason. Cause things always run into, you always, run
yeah,
into
absolutely. Yes.
Manage through that.
With around the bridge loans, you're talking my language here, because you'll see a 1 year or 2 year loan with no options, you know, no option year extensions. Mm-hmm. And those are particularly risky, especially when you don't know where the market's going to be in 2 years. And if you happen to have an issue with the property that you purchased, as far as renovating it, or maybe the market goes down and you can't raise rents.
Yeah.
Now you've got a situation where you need to refinance and maybe you can't, maybe you don't have the income to support a refinance.
Right.
So,
yeah, I think that's
you're right.
To me, that's more important than even where, like, in the shorter term, I mean, outside of a cataclysmic event, right. Outside of us getting into a worldwide war, I think we can be pretty clear on where markets for the most part will be over the next couple of years. The further out it becomes murkier, but over the next year or so, I think we know pretty well. I think what to me is more risky than where the market's going to be is, can you execute your business plan in that time? Because to your point, you have to have the income to be able to get out, to be able to refinance in a way that you're not having to put more money in at that refinance period. And so it's like, the way I look at it is, when can we realistically implement our business plan? And from there, let's put a little cushion on the back
right.
end. Right.
Right.
And so it's about execution, the ability to execute, I think, to be able to get that income, to be able to then refinance in a way that's going to allow you to actually take cash out versus having to put additional cash in.
Right.
Because you can't get the leverage that you're right. looking for, right, on that next loan. I think that's one of the biggest risks people should be looking for is.
Well, and that gets to my point of the sponsors that have long track records and have been around for a long time. You know, they have a history of executing well on their projects. Most of these guys, they've got, you know, contractor relationships. Mm-hmm. They may have their own in-house, you know, that sort of thing. A lot of the new investors or a lot of new sponsors may not have those deep relationships or a backup contractor or whatever to execute per plan. And so even though it may be underwritten in a, you know, achievable manner, maybe they don't have the relationships or the team to drive that, performance at the project level. So again, that's another reason why I think the sponsor and asking the sponsor's track record, especially on execution, like you just said, in order to achieve that refinance, you got to execute. And so seeing what they've done in the past and having that track record is important.
Yeah, absolutely. Track record is important. I think everybody has to start somewhere though. So I think I'm quite as heavy-handed as you are when it comes to track record and positioning, but I think it's important for people to be able to relate whatever success that they've had in their life to how that's going to make them successful in real estate. And then I think as you develop a track record, which can come pretty quickly, I think it's important to have one, to be able to communicate that, and two, to be able to show those proof points, right? And I think that, you know, yes, the companies that have been around forever and should have those things in place, they can operate in some ways better than some of the smaller ones. But honestly, on other times, I see larger firms that have become kind of the big corporations and more layers and more bureaucratic can be slower to move on opportunities and can have more layers and more friction on execution. So really, I think to me, it's a balance, right? If you have some executors who are really nimble and can get really creative and don't have all the policies in place to the point where they can, you know, they can do what needs to be done, not kind of be boxed in. I think there's value there too. So it's,
so I agree with that. I believe that there is a place in your portfolio for, you know, those investments, but you need to weigh them against, you know, more safer investments as well. So
sure,
that's the diversification play. You know, I focus sure. my investing and my funds on, you know, this long-term foundational investment with companies that have been around for a long time that, mm-hmm. You know, have proven track record. And then of course we invest in other things that are more risky and should produce a higher return. Right. But that's all part of an allocation strategy mm-hmm. specific to what I do. Right.
Yeah. No, I think, and obviously that diversification is so important. So Mark, as we're winding things down here, I wanted to ask you, you've been in real estate, your wife's family's been in real estate for a long time. You guys have done a lot of different things. You made a lot of investments. What are some of the mistakes that you've personally made that you've learned from, and how can people avoid those?
Well, I think we've talked around a lot of them. You know, a lot of what I discussed earlier, it comes from lessons learned. So things like being too aggressive, like a moth to a flame of chasing the next trend. You know, when I originally got interested in real estate, we really went down the path of becoming an active syndicator, not realizing how much time and effort that took to, you know, you're creating your own job, right? You're not doing this on the side. It takes dedication to really be a successful hands-on operator, if that's what you're trying to do. And so we did that with a number of partners in the mobile home park space. We executed well, but realized ultimately that it was more than what we could handle as professionals. And so, you know, we're winding that down, but that was one lesson, right? Don't bite off kind of more than you can chew and go in with your eyes wide open. You know, we did, I have seen some aggressive underwriting. I've been on some underwriting that we were too aggressive and had expectations of markets, that did not turn the way that we expected them to, or we weren't able to raise rates. We weren't able to, you know, turn over the clientele as quickly as we wanted to and thought we could. You know, they didn't turn into big portfolio killers or anything like that, but we didn't lose money. However, they didn't perform as well as we expected. So a lot of those mistakes that I talked about earlier, I've seen in my own, you know, experience at this point.
Gotcha. Well, no, those are great lessons to take away. I think those are great, as well as the ones you mentioned earlier. So I want to take you through our keys to success round. We've got four questions that I like to ask you. The first one is, if you were going to invest money with somebody else and you could only ask them one question, what is the one question you'd ask?
I would definitely ask, what's your track record, right? I believe that 80% of your returns, you know, can be predicted by the track record. You know, it's the 80-20 rule that you always hear. And if you hit on that, what's your track record and experience? You can follow up with the other 20% and weed out most of the riffraff right up front. and then get into the underwriting of their models and their, you know, financials and all of that sort of thing can come later, in my opinion. Especially if you're just making a foundational investment that's like diversification from your 401k, right? I'm just venturing in to real estate. I want to make, you know, a comparatively safe investment. Focus on track record first. You can come back to the other 20% later when you get some experience. So that would be what I would ask.
And that's a great point. I think you're hitting on one of the kind of key foundations of what we talk about a lot on this podcast, which is really, it starts with the sponsor first, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is all about the sponsor. And so you're understanding the sponsor before you're understanding the deal, right? You're vetting the sponsor before you're vetting the deal. And I think that that's right on. So Mark, what are you most proud of in your career?
Well, I'm very proud of my role as the CFO of Cogent Security, which is the firm that, like I said earlier, I was consulting for, and ultimately turning that into a partnership with, you know, the founder and becoming the CFO. Very proud of that. Also very proud of my wife and recognizing the opportunity to get into real estate investing, opening my eyes, and then really just taking the steps to pivot multiple times to figure out how it best fit for our needs. And so we're definitely feeling comfortable with where we are now. And I'm very proud of that in, you know, developing these funds for people like ourselves.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What is a book that everybody should read?
So Private Equity, Real Estate, PERE by Sean Cook, I think is a very foundational book for busy professionals that want to, you know, venture into some of this. I think it's called Private Equity, Real Estate Investing, something like that. I can give you the link exactly. That's one. Scaling Up. I got a bunch of books back here on my shelf that I go through, but that's another one. Traction. Sorry, gave you three.
No, those are good. I actually have not heard of that first one, Private Equity Real Estate Investing. I'll have to check that out.
Sean Cook. I know that's the pseudonym that he uses.
Yeah. Well, we will put the links to all those in the show notes so people can access them easily. And Mark, last but not least, what is your number one key to success?
So it's finding time to focus. It's time management and, you know, really blocking off my time. So as a busy professional, you've got multiple things coming at you all the time. You know, things come up, payroll has to be run. Somebody's got a question about their benefits, you know, all of those things happen. But you have to be able to block your time to focus on, you know, key things and knock them out, right? Mm-hmm. Make lists, tell yourself when you're going to do X, Y, Z in that block of time and do it, you know, turn off your notifications if you need to. That's been my key to success is, you know, focus and time management and blocking.
Yeah, no, I think that's awesome. I think I'm a huge proponent of blocking time, getting into some deep work, really putting, you know, hours of focus, you know, into one thing and getting it done versus scattering across many. I think you'll find it be so much more productive. So,
and you just mentioned another book, Deep Work by, I think it's Cam Newton or Cal Newton.
Yes, Deep Work. That is a great book. I can't remember the author's name either, but we'll link it in the notes so everybody has that. Because that is another great one, and I follow a lot of those principles.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah.
Well, very good, Mark. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and providing value. If folks want to be able to get a hold of you, they want to learn more about what you're doing, how can they reach you?
Sure. They can reach out to me through sierracapitalgroup.com. That's C-I-R-A. capitalgroup.com. And you can just go to our website. There's a contact us page. We're launching a fund right now that's foundational. Like I said, just all of the things I've talked about, maximum diversification with some sponsors that have been around for a long time. And we'll have something like more than 40 assets in that fund between two sponsors with lots of track record.
Gotcha. Well, very good. Well, we'll include that as well. So folks can reach you on the website. And with that, Mark, hope you have a great rest of the day.
Excellent. Thanks, Kent.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of Ritter on Real Estate. Hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss out on the content that will make you a better investor. Also, visit KentRitter.com for articles, videos, and tools curated just for passive investors. Until next time, this is Kent Ritter with Ritter on Real Estate. Now go out and invest like a pro.